And now, it's time for the talk of the Northwest. The 9 to Noon Show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. It's 3.5 minutes past nine on this Wednesday, the 23rd of April. How are you all keeping? I do hope you're very well indeed. We're broadcasting, of course, here from the northwest of Ireland, and it's a beautiful sunny morning, nice and bright, and not too chilly too. But it just does tend to put a little bit of a spring in one step, doesn't it? Anyway, I hope you have a great day, and I hope you spend much of it with us here at Highland Radio. Over the next 3 hours, we've got all the usual mix here. We're going to be covering the big issues of the day, of course. We've got interviews, platforming, community fundraisers, people in the community, all that, the usual mix. And your views and comments critical to all of that, of course. 086 60 25000, that's the WhatsApp and text number. And don't forget, if you want to send in WhatsApp voice notes, feel free to do so too, whether it's a request or a comment or an issue you wish to raise. We love getting them. We can play them out as well. 086 60 25000, or maybe it's a better way for you to communicate. You can also give us a call here on 07491 25000. The steady hand on the tiller, of course, Caroline Orr researching and producing, and Shannon Wilkins working on the show very hard as well. Emails, comments at highlandradio.com. Watch the show if you want on our YouTube channel at home, on your smart TV or your Fire Stick, Highland Radio Ireland, or across our Facebook pages and on the X platform. Let's have a look at some of the newspapers today. We'll start off with the local out today, Finn Valley Voice. One of Donegal's most important ambassadors, Lottie the Doll, is waiting to find out if she's invited to the United States this Christmas. Lottie, coming from a product line that consciously avoids the unhealthy sexualization practiced by her rivals, is eagerly sought out by American parents as Christmas parents. Presents, the American markets account for 70% of all Lottie sales, but the Christmas ordering season is upon us and Lottie needs to get her invitation pretty soon, and her prospects are shrinking. Says Lottie entrepreneur Ian Harkin. We spoke to Ian Harkin the day Donald Trump announced his tariffs. The complication for them is that they produce these dolls in China, and the United States has imposed very heavy tariffs on China. But funny, and this is how quick things can move, still a really important article, and you can read that in the Finn Valley Voice, but there's been a bit of a rollback from the US administration listening to some of Donald Trump's commentary overnight. He has sort of suggested that he's going to drop the China tariffs, not because China have agreed to anything that he wants them to agree to, but the American economy is going down the toilet. Inflation is on the way up, and income is, the bond markets are unstable, the share markets are unstable, and he's going to voluntarily drop the tariffs on China, which is good news, I would hope, for the likes of Lottie Dolls and others. Powell, too, he was putting pressure on him, saying he should be sacked to drop the interest rates over there. Now he's endorsing Mr. Powell and saying that he's not going to get sacked. Elon Musk has committed to pull back from Doge, the Department of Government Excess, is it, or expenditure, because Tesla stocks, their earnings, down 70%. Their stocks are still down. And it's all sort of kind of changing, not because China or Europe or anyone else is backing down. It's because they're having to roll back on some of the decisions that they made. So Donald Trump separating himself from Mr. Powell so that the American economy seems somewhat independent from him. Elon Musk pulling out to a great extent. And also Donald Trump committing to dropping tariffs, even though he really hasn't won anything in terms of tariffs. So it's all change, and it changes really, really quickly. Let's start with the Irish Times in terms of the national newspapers, and the same picture is on the front of or inside all of the papers, and it's Francis, Pope Francis, lying in rest. World leaders will gather in Rome on Saturday for the funeral of Pope Francis, the Vatican has confirmed, as tributes to the late pontiff continued worldwide. The Pope's body will lie in state in St. Peter's Basilica for the next 3 days, where thousands of Catholics are expected to pay their respects. I'm sure people from other religions as well. Meanwhile, preparations for Saturday's funeral, including a big security operation around the Vatican, were getting underway as the world's media arrived in Rome in advance on the weekend's events. In advance on the week's events and the papal conclave to select the next Pope. which will follow. US President Donald Trump, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky were among the many world leaders who said they would attend Saturday's funeral. The Republic will be represented by President Michael D. Higgins and his wife Sabrina, accompanied by Taoiseach Micheál Martin and Taoiseach Simon Harris. The government confirmed that flags will be flown at half-mast over public buildings on Saturday to mark the somber occasion. And if you didn't listen to yesterday's show, by the way, a lot of interesting conversation in relation to the passing of Pope Francis. People, local people, sharing their memories of meeting him, and a very interesting conversation in the third part of the podcast, if you want to tune into that, with Dr. Joe Kelly, where he discusses what is next in terms of the selection of a new pope and a little bit of a history to former popes and the church in general. So if you missed that yesterday, some of you tune out after 11, I'm sure, as some of you tune in. That's available on our podcast, on our website, and it's in the last hour we speak to Dr. Kelly. Just a heartbreaking story. I'm not sure, it would be heartbreaking in any case, but I suppose those of us with young children, you kind of sort of think there, but for the grace of God, go I. It's a terribly sad story from the Irish Independent. A young boy who died after being hit by a car in a housing estate had celebrated his fourth birthday over the Easter weekend. The child has been named locally as Abdur Rahman. The fatal collision happened in Mullingar in County Westmeath shortly after 6 p.m. on Monday. He was treated at the scene before being taken by ambulance to Mullingar Hospital, where he was pronounced dead. Yesterday morning, Garda Forensic Collision investigators towed away the car suspected to have been involved in the incident. An extensive Garda investigation, which is now underway in an attempt to establish the cause of the tragedy. A Garda cordon has since been lifted, with Garda eager to speak to any road users in the area or pedestrians who may have been in the area at the time of the incident. They're looking for the dash cam footage and usual stuff, of course, to our listenership. Very unlikely to have any information. But the young lad had just celebrated his birthday. I don't think he'd opened all his presents, and he was out on a scooter when the incident happened. And it's just absolutely heartbreaking to read that story. The Irish Daily Mail this morning on housing. Surging house prices could rise even more if plans to extend first-time buyers' grants are followed through on, finance officials have warned. Internal briefing documents prepared for Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue, obtained by the Irish Daily Mail, caution that extending grants to second-hand homes, which have has since been provided for in the programme for government, represents an additional upside risk to prices. The Help to Buy and First Home schemes, which only apply to newly built properties, are widely agreed by experts, including the ESRI and Central Bank, to have driven up house prices. And there's lots of factors, lots of pressure, because, you know, if there are grants available for vacant or derelict properties, I'm sure builders factor that in. If there's grants or money available to replace defective concrete homes, it's factored in. If people know that there's more spending power with government support to buy people's first homes, that's factored in house prices. And whilst it's designed, much of this is designed to help people, it does put pressure, because not enough houses are being built. So there's an upward pressure on those that are being built. So I wouldn't have to be a financial expert to understand why house prices are continuing to rise. What's needed is just more houses to be built, maybe the state to build more of those houses to take the pressure off the market, rather than giving those with money extra money to buy houses. I'm not saying that scheme shouldn't happen. I'm just saying we should know the consequences of that. The Irish Daily Star this morning, and following on from our conversation during the Community Garda information, this story did catch my eye. Nearly 150 motorists were arrested by Gardaí over the Easter bank holiday weekend for driving under the influence, it's been revealed. Since Thursday, there's been an extensive Garda roads policing operation, which ended yesterday morning at 7 a.m. As part of the extensive operation, more than 912 mandatory intoxicant testing checkpoints were carried out, over 4,500 breath tests, 213 oral fluid tests were performed, which led to, and this is the figure I found interesting, 149 arrests for driving under the influence of an intoxicant, drug or drink. Now, we learnt yesterday 16 of those were in County Donegal, which represents in excess of 10%. Now, I presume these are full national figures as they've been printed in a national newspaper. Isn't it quite remarkable that County Donegal, one of 26 counties, would account for an excessive 10% of those found to be under the influence of drink and drugs? What does that say? Or does that mean Gardaí are more active here? Does that mean we're more inclined to drive under the influence in Donegal? It's not a really good figure to be looking at. Over 10% of the published detections were in County Donegal, 16 from 149. That is, what is it, about 11.2%, something along those lines? Kind of worrying. Reading in the Irish Daily, in the Irish Sun today, Gardaí have searched a mobile home in Donegal owned by child sex offence suspect Father Edward Gallagher. This is part of their investigation. He appeared before a special sitting of Derry Magistrates Court, charged that on dates between April 2nd and 17, 2025, he attempted sexual communication with a child. The nature of those allegations somewhat outlined in the video, which I'm sure many of you have watched. The 58-year-old cleric was suspended from his post in the Derry Diocese after he was charged. He is the curate for the Camas Clonlea and Lechpatrick parishes, which include St. Patrick's Church in Murlough Lifford, where he is the regular celebrant. His arrest and charge occurred last week on foot of a number of allegations put to him. He has subsequently appeared in court. The priest, with an address at Orchard Park in Lifford, spoke only to confirm his identity and that he understood the charges. No application for bail was made, with the case being adjourned until May. Following the arrest, cops visited a mobile home in Buncrana on the Inishowen Peninsula owned by the priest. The Garda Press office was contacted for a reaction to the development. However, a spokesperson said they do not comment on inquiries which may relate to an ongoing investigation. They don't respond to queries either, sort of as it relates to a named individual. There you are. That is a both sides of the border investigation now, clearly. At least 26 Palestinians have been killed, including 11 believed burned to death in Israel attacks on Gaza. The brutality, the tragedy continues for the people of Gaza. This reported in the Irish Daily Mirror. Bodies were pulled out of the rubble of a housing complex in the southern city of Khan Yunis after an assault which killed 9, including a 2-year-old girl. Her grandfather, Awad Dabli, said, they had nothing to do with anything. What is the fault of this innocent child? It's not known if the 11 who reportedly burned to death included the 9 in the multi-story home. Gaza's health ministry said a number of victims remain under the rubble and on the roads, unable to be reached by ambulances and civil defence crews. Yesterday's pre-dawn strikes also hit a local authority building with a garage containing 9 bulldozers provided by Egypt and Qatar during the recent ceasefire to help the clearing and rebuilding. So even the machinery being gifted into Gaza to help make it somewhat livable is targeted now, or at least is collateral damage of their targets, or however they may choose to phrase it. Palestinian officials say at least 51,266 people have been killed in the response to the death of 1,200 people who were killed when Hamas-led militants invaded Israel on October 7th, 2023. That seems like a long time ago, but every day since, the people of Gaza have been pummeled by neighbouring Israel. We're joined on the programme now by the Donegal Central Executive Committee representative with the INTO, Áine McGinley. Áine, good morning to you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Good morning, Greg. It's great to be on the show. Thanks very much.
Now, the INTO Annual Congress is underway in Galway. What's the general mood before we get into some specifics amongst teachers?
I suppose our members are energised. They're very engaged. There's great debate happening. It's been a wonderful Congress so far. We're on day 3 here now. This is our final day. We listened with great interest, I suppose, to what Minister McEntee had to say to us yesterday. But it's been a fantastic Congress so far. Our members are really energised and engaging well.
One of the resolutions passed was highlighting growing concern over the unsustainable workload facing school principals across the country. What's the lived reality?
The lived reality is complete burnout. Our members are very exercised about this. It is an issue that we have been debating at Congress, unfortunately, for a number of years now. The lack of supports really for school leaders. We've been calling for additional post responsibility to help ease the burden on school principals so that they can delegate tasks. Literal over burnout. Overburdened system and complete burnout is coming up time and time again, and our members are really just exhausted at this stage. Between lack of supports for school leaders and lack of funding, it's been a difficult situation for a lot of our school leaders. And in fact, we noticed that a number of people are actually just not applying for school leadership positions for these particular reasons.
And what are the solutions being proffered by the INTO into this? What would make the situation better?
Well, increased investment would be the first key. Whenever we did a survey there recently of our school leaders, and one of the top three issues that cause of workload concerns for our members is actually class size. And we've been calling for a reduction of class size for years. But for the last 2 years, the government haven't reduced the class size at primary level at all. Now, I know in the programme for government, they have absolutely agreed to do that over the next 4 years. But while the EU, we're still among the highest EU average. But in Ireland, the class size average is 23 pupils, and we need that reduced to 19.
And there has been a commitment, hasn't there, to fast track student teachers into permanent contracts. I mean, I speak to people all of the time, as you do too, you know, and they've just qualified as a teacher, for an example. And you think, okay, brilliant. We need teachers. You know, take your pick of full-time jobs, but it doesn't work like that. Are you encouraged by the commitment from government to fast-track newly qualified teachers, or is it we'll believe it when we see it?
No, we're encouraged certainly by the commitment there. It's 1 year less that the teachers will get a permanent contract given, provided that there is a viable contract for them for the following year. So it will get people a permanent job quicker. But that's only one of a number of measures that's going to be needed to fill these posts. We need to encourage more people into the profession. So a number of initial teacher education places needs to be increased. We need more post responsibility so that the teachers who are teaching in the likes of Dubai and Saudi Arabia, that they'll be actually encouraged to come home because they're getting post responsibility abroad, but there isn't that incentive for them to come back. So we need to incentivise the profession. Certainly would be, and that post responsibility would be a huge thing for us.
And pardon my ignorance, maybe you've actually referenced this. Is there still an issue where their career progression is not recognised here in Ireland? So if you go over there and work very well for two to 3 years, you come back, you're at square one effectively. That doesn't really make any sense. We should be saying, right, brilliant, you can come home now, and you're probably actually even more rounded than you would be now if you'd never left.
Exactly, Greg, and that's actually one of the lists of things that we've given to the department to actually say we need to incentivize them and reward them for that service that they've had abroad, because they're bringing back experience that they're not being rewarded for when they do come back to us.
There's lots going on that's interesting, but of course, you know, parents listening might have a particular interest in the majority of primary school teachers being of the view that families or parishes should be responsible for preparing children for sacraments of communion and confirmation. Is this about a separation of school and religion, or is this about workload and maybe time, you know, that could be spent elsewhere being spent on these matters? Or what do you think the reasons behind these opinions are?
I think it's probably a combination of all of this. Whenever we surveyed our members from a Congress motion actually last year, we found the exact same information as what the census data told us, that the families need more of a choice with regards to patronage or not non-religious schools. But I think probably it's not a case that we don't want to teach religion. It's just a case that our curriculum is completely overburdened. Our staff are completely overburdened. And it's more a case that we need to concentrate on curriculum and moving things forward like that. I mean, we're not shirking our responsibility in terms of not wanting to teach religion, but it's just our curriculum is so heavily overburdened at the moment that something has to give.
Yeah, but there is also a sense amongst two-thirds of teachers that primary schools should be secular as opposed to having religious patrons. So that talks a little bit more to the ethos, that doesn't it, than the workload.
Exactly, yeah.
So what I can't expect you to get into the minds of 1,000 teachers, right? But what do you think, why do you think teachers feel that way?
I just think, I suppose, our schools have changed over the last number of years. We're children coming from all different parts of the world because of war-torn situations. And I think we've just got to move with the times.
Yeah. What has jumped out for you? I've just picked a few things that I thought of interest, but I mean, you're down there and you know the hot topics and what's vexing teachers. What else has been up for discussion of note?
Actually, just at the moment, the first motion this morning has been on the need to enact the reproductive health leave bill from 2021. I know that Senator Ivana Bacik brought that forward, and we were making great progress with that until the government decided last year to postpone it for 12 months, which basically leaves it to the next government, which is this current government now, to enact. Because we noticed that, and I know a lot of my own members in Donegal and Leitrim would have contacted me about this, whether a teacher has gone through early pregnancy loss or whether they're going through fertility treatments, they're having to either take unpaid leave or sick leave, or indeed actually turn up to school going through that bereavement or going through that difficult time. So we're trying to make sure now and put pressure on the government to enact that legislation so that there would be up to 20 days of bereavement or of leave for a teacher who's gone through early pregnancy loss, because at the moment they can only avail of it if they're after 24 weeks of pregnancy, or it would be up to 10 days of leave for reproductive health.
Yeah.
So that the teachers have time to deal with their current situations. That's a point that's been debated there this morning.
I imagine teachers will vote unanimously in favour of that as well, because it makes a lot of sense. And it's a conversation that's happening right across sort of, you know, workplaces, not exclusively teachers, of course. It's one thing maybe having a minister that understands the issues, you know, but you don't want them nodding along with you going, yeah, this is terrible, right? You want them to sort of be solution focused and sort of to take on board what you're saying and saying, right, OK, maybe now is the opportunity for change. Do you get that impression from the current minister?
She was very engaging with us yesterday, I have to give her that. And she, as you say, was very cognizant of the issues that we have. She has committed to putting in a therapies in schools project together, which is something that we've been absolutely calling for years. We need those services coming into schools where the children are, because the children who are losing out most are the children with special educational needs. The list is endless with regards to the issues there. But that therapies in schools project, hopefully, as I say, she's committed to it, but hopefully it'll be underway very, very soon. That's something that we've been calling for, and it will make life a lot easier, and it will help those children with special needs to get the support that they so rightly deserve and they so much need.
Yeah, and it's about funding too and resources, isn't it? I mean, it's such an important part of our lives. In the primary school, it sets us up, because you're on a journey now, and that journey starts in Nina often, or preschool now, and carries on through. I think we're more organised. You know, it's an entire process. So anywhere that we drop the ball, all children don't get equal sort of, you know, resources and attention, or extra resources or attention where needed. Like, we're failing children, really. And you know, of course, then we're failing teachers, because teachers are in the classroom, and you guys see the actual impact on our young people when things aren't being done correctly. And it's really important, I think, that your voices are listened to, because you see what we don't see as parents. We've a great deal of trust in teachers, and rightly so, it's earned.
Absolutely. And I suppose we've been calling out the lack of government support for schools for years, and the lack of funding. And as you mentioned funding there, Greg, it's been highlighted by our union members over and over again, and in particular at this Congress, where a child in primary level is worth, in inverted commas, €283. But once they go to second level, it's well over €300. Mm. Euro. And how is a child in sixth class in June worth 283, yet once they start first year in September, they're worth so much more? The capitation at primary has got to be increased. The funding at primary level has to be increased. As you say, it's about starting off at primary, at primary level, give them a strong education. Education is the way forward to have a strong and healthy country, really, and it's so important. But it's just our members are at breaking point at this stage.
And of course, often parents have to fill the gap there as well too. And I'm sure schools think, oh, we can't go back to the parents again, can we?
This is the thing that the government have told us as well, that they don't want parents having to foot the bill, but yet schools literally can't afford to pay their bills at the moment. The cost of electricity, the cost of insurance is skyrocketing, but yet schools aren't being given enough money to actually run their schools. So we're having to do fundraisers still, which we don't like to do. And I suppose we're, by doing that, we're also letting the government away with not taking up their own responsibility.
Yeah, I think if you were dropped into Ireland from space and you were told that, you know, schools are given a certain amount of money and that money doesn't cover the basics, right? You would go, well, seriously, but sure, the state is responsible for funding the basics, surely. Just back to the religion side of things, if you don't mind, just a few people are very interested in this. Again, I mean, is it that the school population is getting more and more diverse and it's more complicated to teach Catholicism, say, for instance, as an example? Is that the root cause of this? I think you talked about more diversity, you know, that there are children coming into schools from different backgrounds. Why would that be why would that be a reason for you know, more secular schools and go ahead, sorry, Anya, I hope I haven't misquoted you.
No, you're okay. No, I wouldn't have said it's harder to teach Catholicism because there are other children
or
from
any
other
religion.
Faiths, I think we have to acknowledge other faiths in the schools, because at the end of the day, I believe that if you're teaching Catholicism, you're teaching it by the way you live as well. So it's the way we treat other people. It's a Christian values. I don't think that it's people are saying by any means that you can't teach religion because there's children from other faiths there. I just think we have to be cognizant that there are children from other faiths.
So it's about being more considerate as opposed to it being more complicated, as I say.
Absolutely, yeah.
I wanted to ask you that whilst you were on, so I didn't misframe it, so I am pleased that I did. Okay, Anya, thank you very much. I'll let you get back, obviously. When does matters conclude down there? Today's the last day in Galway, is it not?
It is indeed, yeah. So about 3 o'clock this afternoon.
All right, safe home. Thank you very much indeed. Anya McGinley, Donegal Central Executive Committee representative with the INTO. The removal of sacrament preparation from schools is disgraceful, says a listener. Why are teachers leading this in Catholic ethos schools? Shame on our teachers, says a listener. Well, it's not all... you know, 1,000 teachers were surveyed, 2/3 believe that. So let's not, you know... throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's the opinion of a sample of teachers. In some jobs, you can take a leave of absence. You get 4 or 5 years off. They go away to another country. You aren't supposed to take this leave if it will affect the service. Have we got any figures to show how many teachers are on leave working in other countries? When I worked in the health board, we weren't allowed to take leave if there was no one to cover. That's just some of them that are coming in. Greg, could we encourage people to fly the papal flag at half-mast as a mark of respect to our Pope? Let's see how many public buildings will show respect to our Catholic leader in our Catholic country by flying it at half-mast. Spain is 3 days of mourning. I don't see Ireland doing anything. Well, the flags are being lowered, a diktat from the government suggesting so. Greg, I'm trying to understand how there's so much hype on the death and funeral of Pope Francis, and 40,000 civilians, including 15,000 children, were murdered, and all main media keep their head down with a lot agreeing with this slaughter. I believe it's in excess of 50,000. It's 51,000 people. I presume you're referencing the Middle East. There are significant people in this world, Donald Trump, whoever is that happens to be the president of America at any given time, the head of the Roman Catholic Church, the leader of China. You know, there are a small number, Vladimir Putin might be among them. There are a small number of people that are very, very significant in the world. And the way the news has traditionally worked, whether it'll continue to be this case or not, is there's a massive amount of interest, public interest. Some people... In the general population, have to give their minds a break from the terrible situation in the Middle East. They can't continue to focus on it because then they can't. They have to raise their children, pay their mortgage, live in a defective concrete block home. The truth is it's never going to be ever present. The news will move on even as the tragedy continues. It's terrible. It is absolutely terrible. But if you were to have the Daily Star newspaper, for an example, and you were to put the Gaza situation on the front of that paper every day, you know, in about 10, 15 days, you would start seeing your circulation decrease. This is just the reality of it. But you stick on the front page the information about the Pope or whatever is just breaking at that time. People will go into the newsagents and pick the paper up. So whilst the media has a responsibility as well, the public too have a role to play in this and what they're interested in. And even on our own website, you can go into the back end and click on the stories that people are interested in. We don't tailor our news in that regard. We just put our news out as we put our news out. But you could, and it would alter sort of the news stories that are carried on a website like ours. But as I say, we don't. We cover all stories and put them on. But I get where you're coming from. But it's just not reality that, as tragic as the situation in the Middle East is that it's going to be headline news all of the time. Because even when we were talking about it, as it was raging and continues to rage, people were saying, you know, is there nothing else going on? That's very heavy. Do we have to keep listening about this? I'm not talking about any editorial policies here. I'm talking about the reality sort of media and our consumption of it. And it is also very importantly about people's consumption of such. Okay, back after this break. Any comments in relation to that? As I say, I'm just spitballing in my head here. As I say, I'm not speaking on behalf of Highland or the editorial policy. It's just an observation as a media consumer that I'm making there. Morning, Greg. Was on the show a few weeks ago talking about the price of house insurance. It went from €300 to €600. I did price around as I wanted to stay local, so I did get €80 cheaper with another company. I went back to my old company, but they wouldn't match it, so I went with the new company. So that was the end result. Thanks, Greg. Thank you. So did you get it? I'm always full of questions here. Did you get it for €520? You hardly got it for €220, so you got it down to €520 from €6. Listen, that €80 better in your pocket than theirs. Thanks for the update there. It's confidential shredding time again on Friday, the 25th of April at the Letterkenny Shopping Centre in association with United Shredding Company and the Letterkenny Rotary Club, and all for just a donation to the Donegal Down Syndrome Association. As usual, the USL unit will be situated on the right-hand side of the car park near the entrance from 10:30 a.m. to midday. So you just come along, and members of the Rotary Club will also be on standby to assist if needed. I'm joined on the programme now by Joe Lochnane. Good morning, Joe. How are you keeping?
Morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for speaking to us. I wish we weren't speaking in this context, but we have to. I'm sorry for the loss of your brother, Adam.
Yes.
Talk to me about the. It's your story, isn't it? And it's Adam's story, I suppose. So where do you want to start with it?
I suppose the best thing to start with is what happened 9 weeks ago now, just over 2 months ago, when on Tuesday, the 11th of February, he woke up in a bad state. He was feeling numb. He contacted his mental health support worker and he told her that he needed help. And within an hour or so, him and his support worker had presented at the emergency department in University Hospital Galway, where he had presented as suicidal. He said to them, both the reception staff, triage nurse, various staff in there, that he wanted to enter the River Corrib, that is, which is just down from, you know, University Hospital Galway. And sadly, he wasn't really believed in that regard. He was made to wait in the waiting room with everybody else who was just waiting in the general A&E waiting room, and he waited there for about an hour and a half there, Greg.
Yeah, and what strikes me about this is, firstly, the fact that he reached out and sought support. He knew where he was at. That's what we tell people. Mm. He presented looking for help. But, you know, we triage people in the EDs. So, say, for instance, University Hospital Galway is the same as our local hospital here. If you go in with a physical ailment, you know, if you present with a suspected stroke, or if you present with a twisted knee, you are fast tracked through to get into the stroke unit, to get that emergency care, because your life is in peril, your life is in danger.
Yes,
the thought that someone with a mental illness in the same situation, the life is in peril, the life is in danger, is not treated as an acute emergency or fast tracked. It's very, very, very worrying.
Greg, that's the part I think that's left us at our most kind of desperate over the last while, is that had, as you said there, that being a cardiac arrest or some sort of emergency on a physical health emergency. He would definitely either still be alive now or he would have passed because of that emergency, but he would have got the care. And as you said there, in reaching out, Adam packed a bag before he left his apartment that afternoon to go to the hospital. He put a pair of socks and a pair of pajamas in it. He genuinely was of the opinion and of the belief that he was handing himself over to the hospital there, essentially. You know, he was saying to them, look, I can't look after myself. I need to be sectioned. Because this is something that had done to him, been done to him before, about 8 years previous, in the very same hospital. So they knew exactly that this was somebody who wasn't, it wasn't something new. It was a problem that he'd been dealing with in the past. Yet still, he was made to wait. In more recent days, Greg, we've been told by the hospital that they use, there's a system in Ireland, the triage system. It's called the Manchester triage system. And there's different categories in that. And Adam was deemed a category two. Now, when they told us what that means is he needs to be seen within 10 minutes. Mm. Now, they admitted to me that because of the understaffing and the under-resourcing of hospitals, especially University Hospital Galway, and I know people in Donegal know that hospital well. Across the whole of the west of Ireland, mm-hmm. everybody goes to that main hospital. It serves quite a lot of people in the north and in the west. Adam went there of the belief that, you know, when he was seen, that when they were categorizing him as a level two, that he would be seen within 10 minutes. The hospital said they didn't. They couldn't see him. And very often they don't meet those timelines. But that he was waiting for an hour and a half. Mm. And that we've been told as well by a young woman that was in the same waiting room. We've been public about this, that she saw him crying and in distress. And it's not often, Greg, that you see a man in his 30s crying and, you know, blubbering and whimpering to himself in a public area like that. You don't see it that often because young men full stop, we're not encouraged to show our emotions. We don't. So if a man like this was doing that, he couldn't be more obvious to open up to the world around him to say, I'm at my lowest here. I'm at my most vulnerable. I need help. And even that young woman who had her own mental health problems could see that, hugged him, sat with him. But when he walked out, she didn't know that that was him walking away. And from the timeline and what we looked at, it was about 10 minutes after he walked out of the A&E, Greg, that he was in the River Guard.
Recent report published on mental health services, and I'll just bring it back closer to the Northwest for a moment, if you don't mind. Letterkenny University Hospital was found to have a huge disconnect between the emergency department and mental health services. The report from the Mental Health Commission revealed that there is a distinct disparity in how mental health patients are treated in the ED. The report shows the need to increase the range of acute mental health services nationally, which would include your hospital, of course, to improve urgent access and quality of unscheduled mental health care. The commission found that Letterkenny University Hospital's ED doesn't have an established process for identifying mental health patients who require further care. Now, the Manchester Protocol is employed in Galway. I'm not sure if that's present in Letterkenny University Hospital. That language there would indicate it's not. But yeah. That report came in between Adam's passing and this conversation. Mm-hmm. It's the problem is recognised, if you know what I mean. But what you're doing is you're actually giving a voice, a face, and a person to that story. So in other words, the failures there impacted Adam.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So
they're
recognizing there is an issue. We have lost Adam. We don't know how many others your family's brave to speak out in this regard, particularly, and I think it's so critical, particularly so soon after your devastating loss. So we know the problems, we know what can happen, we know the loss of life and the devastation, what's going to happen next. And unfortunately, this is where these stories tend to run out of steam. We get a report, we hear the impacts of the negative elements of mental health services, and then we run for another 4 or 5 or 6 years. And how many more Adams do we lose in the interim?
Yes, I agree, Rick. I agree. And I think the big part of us going public with Adam's story has been the large amount of people to contact us with loved ones or of their own situation. And this is going back 10, 20, 30 years where they've lost people through suicide. in not just University Hospital Galway, every hospital, every healthcare facility in the country. I think when people see what we were saying about Adam, what Adam had to go through, they felt the courage to be able to tell us that. And they felt the courage to be able to say to us, look, can you share our story too? We've sent a lot of this correspondence in the last 2 months to both the Minister for Health and the Minister of State for Mental Health. We've made it clear to them, look, this is not an isolated case. This has happened before. Sadly, it's happened again since. We've also been contacted by people in Limerick, where it's happened in the last couple of weeks, where a young man was let out of the A&E department, entered the river, but thank God he was saved by the RNLI just in time. For us, and the reason we went public, Greg, and this is the big thing, is we don't want Adam's name to just be that. Do you know what I mean? Adam died and that was it. He died with his problems and no one ever cared. We want his name to be associated with change. And that means, sadly, that grieving part, which a lot of families get to do in those weeks and months, I haven't been able to do that, Greg. I just said, no, there's no time for this. Because if I don't do it, Adam's story will be completely forgotten about. And not just young people, but a lot of young men, especially Adam, in that age group. I know, Greg, I'm 38. I'm just out of that age group. That 25 to 35-year-old, there's a huge amount of those young men of all nationalities, of all backgrounds, it doesn't matter where they're from, who are dying by suicide. And Adam was, I know, because I was with him the weeks beforehand. I took him out for drinks for his birthday just a month before he died. I was with him for coffee a week before he passed. I could see there were problems. But I could also see a young man who was trying to reach out. He was trying to navigate a complex myriad of avenues of how to get counselling, how to get a mental health support worker, how to get some sort, even a bed for a place in the psych ward or the mental health unit. He was a highly intelligent man, so he was able to work out most of these things. But ultimately, when he was at his most vulnerable, when he was in that emergency situation, as you said there, that report confirms that there is no other avenue. If you are in that emergency situation, you have to go to an A&E in your main hospital. And that is where the failure starts. That's where for me, where the loss of life begins. Why we've spoken out, why we've launched a petition against it, is we're saying there has to be an alternative there. You can't expect people who are at their lowest, who are dealing with pure demons in their head, to sit in a room which is loud, probably full of kids who might have a sick, or might be cold, full of somebody who might have been out the night before, who broken their ankle, full of somebody who's got somebody's got a chest infection. And you're sitting there seeing these people with their visible problems, feeling like a burden. And you're being told, you just have to wait. You have to wait. Of course. You walked away.
It's purposely emotive, because you've included in your story, and I think it's very important too that people understand. Adam left that hospital, obviously desperate. He entered the river and passed away. He was back in that hospital very shortly afterwards, and you and his family were there, his life extinguished. Him lost to you guys in the very same place he walked out of, because he felt like he couldn't get any assistance. And I think very fairly to the family too, you've not pointed the finger at individuals or the family. It's the system that you're talking of. But that's going to take some processing, that, you know, that he ended up back there. But unfortunately, yeah, it was too late.
3 hours, Greg. That was a 3-hour timeline. He walked into the hospital at 2 o'clock. He walked out of the hospital around 4 o'clock. He was pulled out of the river around 10 to 5 and brought back to the hospital just after 5 o'clock. And then I went in to identify his body at 6 o'clock that evening.
How can people... Joe.
The only reason we know that, Greg, is a doctor pulled us aside as we were walking out of the waiting room, out of the A&E after we identified him, to say, look, your brother was in this hospital only a couple of hours earlier telling us that he wanted to enter the river. And that's when we decided to go public. Once they told us that he'd been in there, telling them what he wanted to do and that he'd done it, we felt it was necessary to go public then.
How do people support the petition, the campaign, in for your family, to support your family, to support their own families? And just before you say that, you know, because of the position I have here, and I'm pretty accessible through Facebook and stuff, families contact me and after someone's passed, and it's not always publicly known that someone died through suicide, yeah. right? That's yeah. it's just we haven't That's got true. We haven't really sorted all that out yet, be it a single vehicle yeah. collision, sudden death. Some families choose to speak publicly, others, but they do speak to me privately, and it does come up relatively regularly, unfortunately, that they did go to a hospital and, yeah. You know, a day later. It's not always the case, as it was so quick with Adam, which is... So, in other words, this is a problem that we... Because it's suicide and we struggle to talk about it and we don't know how to say the word and we don't, you know, we don't know the numbers, right?
No.
And there is some work going on amongst... coroners to try and tidy this area up so we can get a real sense of what's going on, as terrible as that is, but we need to know. But yeah. with all that in mind, Joe, how do people support you guys in Adam's name?
Yeah, we've launched a petition with Uplift, and it's called Adam's Protocols. Someone who is suicidal shouldn't have to go through A&E. It's got about 15,000 signatures so far. I did an analysis of the signatures. A lot have come from Galway and some of the big cities. It would be great to see more people from across Donegal, because a lot of the stories I'm getting sent directly from people are from people in Donegal talking about the Letterkenny Hospital there and smaller healthcare facilities around the county. That petition, we're using that as the platform to speak to the Minister for Health and the Minister of State for Mental Health. It's specifically calling for two things. Number one, an alternative to A&E. For us, there has to be admission units in the hospitals separate from the A&E. What if we were to drill down on that, what we're saying is the psych wards or mental health units should have a general admission part where if you're suicidal or in a mental health crisis, you walk through there. I think that's standard. That's basic. It's something that used to be done in the past. And secondly, and this directly relates to Adam, Adam should have been secured and monitored, and his health records should have been referenced when he presented as suicidal. We don't believe any of those things were done, because if his health records were referenced, they would have shown that he'd done this, something like this before, which means he would have been secured and monitored. Those are kind of the basic demands in that petition. Like I said, it's getting great support. We were going out into the streets now and onto the roads and talking to people face to face in the next couple of weeks, trying to build it up as well. Any support we can get would be great, because as we said, if this doesn't change, we won't be the last family speaking about this.
No.
And it has to change now.
Yeah,
it has to change.
All right, and people go to Uplift, is it? And the petition is there. Yeah. All right, hey Joe, look after yourself. You know, you've been very busy since, and I think you referenced a little earlier on. Maybe you haven't sat down, but so you look after yourself as well.
Thanks, Brett.
You're doing sterling work. Thanks very much, and love to all the family. All right, and I'm so sorry you lost Adam. I really am, but you've done him proud today, and you are doing him proud. You know that anyway. You don't need me to tell you that. Thanks very much. All right, take care of yourself. Bye bye. You can contact Pieta House, by the way, on 1-800-247-247. The Samaritans are contactable on 1-800-666-666. The teen line is there for you, 1890-927-277. We have to highlight where there are failings and gaps. And even in Adam's case, of course, he did seek assistance, but the system failed him. It doesn't always work like that. So if you are moved by that, if that has... affected you in any way, please don't be afraid to reach out. There is great help and support there. The Gardaí are there as well, 999-112. A lot of people don't realise that they are in emergency services, even in a mental health crisis. But we have to also platform where change is needed. You can go on to Uplift. There's a Justice for Adam and a Justice for many other people affected by that on that website and on their socials.